Welcome to the ASU Sports Business Podcast. Hi everyone, thanks for joining once again. Before we begin this episode will be slightly different. And in fact, it will be the beginning of a new series of podcasts that we will be producing focused on pioneers and innovative leaders within the Pan-African sports space. The reason we are focusing on these leaders and pioneers within the Pan-African sports space is, you know, we do realize that for a sustainable sports ecosystem to be developed, we need the relevant leaders in place to lead these organizations, drive innovation, and help to improve the standard of the landscape as a whole. You know, as they say, the rising tide raises all the boats. So we really wanted to highlight, as we tend to do, well, I really wanted to highlight and champion those people who are already doing wonderful and great things. And so this series will focus on that. And so today, I had the pleasure of talking to Dr. Sheon Adigo. Well, she says I can call her Sheon now. but I had an amazing pleasure of speaking to her. She, if you don't know about her, she is amazing. She's the first African bobsled driver to compete at the Winter Olympics in Pyeongchang in 2018. She's just she's a groundbreaker. She's done so many great things within sports and continues to do so. And we had a wonderful and amazing conversation going all the way back through, you know, her injuries, what she'd done with the Olympics, representing both the US and then Nigeria, and what she's doing now for bobsled and winter sports. So I hope you enjoy. And as usual, please do subscribe to our podcast if you haven't subscribed already. And feel free to subscribe to our newsletter so you can be kept informed of all the latest news and around the whole Pan-African sports space. But enough from me with this intro. You're now here. The conversation I had with Dr. Sheon.
Wonderful. Hi, everyone. Thanks for joining. Hope you're well. And I'm so pleased to have Dr. Sheon with me today. I was literally just saying to her, it feels like I've known her for a long time. I worked on the Olympics that she was part of, one of the broadcasters here in Europe. And I actually told my boss, Clodagh, if you're listening, to get a picture with Dr. Sheon, and she managed to do so. So it feels like it's a long time coming. But thank you so much for joining. How are you doing? How's everything going?
Thank you for having me, Gabriel. I'm doing great. I am doing well. And I always love hearing these stories because I don't think people realize just how much the little things made such a big difference. So getting the stories in the back end, it just helps validate, you know, like everything that we were trying to do and trying to accomplish, it, you know, resonated with people. So thank you for that.
No, 100%. Thank you. Okay, let's get into it. First of all, yeah. I know, you know, Dr. Sheon, should I call you Dr. Sheon? Shall I call you Sheon? What do you prefer?
You can call me Sheon. It's fine. Dr. Sheon is like, you know, honestly, the doctor was something that I never really actually wanted to pick up. I'm not really a person of titles. I've never been. And I, like, for the first, like, year or two after I got my doctorate, I was just kind of like, I mean, I'm still Sheon. And everyone kept telling me I needed to use the doctor. And so it actually happened during COVID when my entire brand went through a rebrand because ultimately, Sheon Adigun, everyone kept, like, it was hard for people to discern between Sheon Adigun, Nigerian bobsled team, bobsled and skeleton federation of Nigeria. Yeah. Like, it just felt like all in one for everyone. And so in this rebrand, it was like, okay, Dr. Sheon is the brand after the Olympics, you know, the retired athlete. the person that's moving on and being just like the face behind what had happened. Mm-hmm. So that's really why Dr. Shell, like the whole stickler of Dr. Shell is a thing, because I could care. I don't really care.
No, it makes sense. Cool, cool. Mm-hmm. And you touched on a few things, which we'll get into in a bit more detail, right? But I guess let's start not from way back, but maybe like college days, or us, for people, I don't know, in the UK or elsewhere, maybe university days, right?
Yeah.
And so you're from a sporting family, which we'll get into. But even just navigating, you know, going to college, you could have done, you know, track and field and basketball at that time. And of course, growing up in a Nigerian household, how was navigating all of that? Was the fact that, you know, you're quite sporty and a sporting family help with those decisions? Or how was that at the time?
Yeah, absolutely. I think coming from a family that has a lot of sports in it, a rich sports history, made it easy for me, because I am the only girl in my family. I have three brothers, and I happen to be the most athletically driven one, because my brothers are all athletic, but I was the one who kind of went after all of the athletic ambition. And so it was a little bit harder for my parents, obviously, as, and I'm sure you can understand, as Nigerians, especially first generation, where a lot of my biggest priority was on sports. Like, that was where my passion was. And being the only girl, it was like, who sent you? Why? What are you looking for in sports? And that would be what people would assume. But my parents were just like, you know, all right, cool. Like, we support you for doing that. And so it made it a lot easier for me to do that, because their only priority was make sure that school is taken care of. Like, just be a good student. You can do basically whatever you want. So I'm very grateful that I had a family unit who understood the value of sports and passion of sports, who have a sports family, and who, you know, were prepared to have me grow in the sports space.
Yeah. So I guess, did they allow you to like explore? Because, you know, you're good at basketball, good at track and field. That was just you exploring what you want to do that you decided on track and field at first, or what?
I played all the sports. All of it. As a matter of fact, track and field was my last sport that I got into. Yes. I played tennis, I played soccer, which are both the sports of my family. So soccer is the sport from my dad's side. And tennis, my mom comes from a big tennis family. And my passion, though, in my neighborhood and where I grew up in, basketball was the sport. And so I started in basketball first when I was a kid. And I just played basketball all the way up and through. Track just happened because I was like this fast, rough little girl who would just chase out, run after all the guys. Or really, I was like racing all the guys, you know, in the streets. And so one of my coaches was like, listen, girl, those legs were born to run. And I would look at him like, nah, I'm a ball player, you know, like I'm a basketball player. And so eventually I listened and I allowed myself to participate in track and field. And then it turned out that I was all right in it.
Yeah, that's good. And I saw, like, in track and field, you've done well at college with NCAA as well. With the loads of medals that you're involved with. Taking it more seriously on the professional stage, right? So representing Nigeria, you even went to London 2012 Olympics.
I did.
How was that as an experience?
I was in your hood.
No, man, the whole time.
That was so much fun because, like, you know, my family that's not in Nigeria is in London. And so when I became a professional athlete, I was based in London, actually, and lived there for the summer. Yeah, a lot of people didn't know, like, I was living in London. I was living in West Drayton and training over at Brunel. And so I would go there every year for 3 years, because it was just so much easier to compete in the European circuit if you're already in Europe. So it was easier for me to be on that side of the world than to be here in the States. And it was like being at home, you know. East London is a little far out, but it was good. It was really cool. Every time I was there, I was like, talking, use your American accent. And I was like, okay. I was like, okay, okay. And, you know, I got to spend my pounds, even though I was very, very distraught when I came back to the United States and realized how much more the pound was as expensive at that time than the dollar. But yeah, no, it was a great time. I had an amazing time in London. It was my first Olympic Games. You know, you can never replace the first experience that you have.
Yeah, and I kind of have like two questions on that, right? So even firstly, of course, you really resonate and engage with like Nigeria and the culture and Africa as a whole, but also of the diaspora, of course, being born in Chicago. Yeah. How did you find it, maybe? Because of course you went to represent actually Nigeria in the 100 meters and actually in London 2012. So how did you find that being sort of the diaspora and then representing Nigeria? How was it in terms of really, or was there a challenge? Was there any difficulty in terms of really engaging with how things are done differently in terms of professionally being set up and also engaging with the cultures and whatnot?
That's such a good question, because I don't think a lot of people realize how difficult it is to make a decision like that. Yeah. You know, there's two sides to this coin, right? Mm-hmm. On one side of the coin, I'm in a place of privilege, right? Yep. Because I have the opportunity to choose who I can represent, where a lot of people in the professional space don't even have that opportunity to choose. You know, they have to make one team and one team only. So there's that. But then on the second side of the coin, especially, you know, and it's, back then sounds really weird to say because that was only 2009, but that feels a lot like back then because so much has changed in the professional space, especially when it comes to sport. But especially then, brands, sponsors, people were not investing in Africa, looking at Africa. The shoe companies were saying, you know, why would we sign you if you choose to compete for Africa? We're not selling any shoes in Africa, you know? And so when I came out of college, I was ranked number two in the country for NCAA under all conditions. And then I was ranked number six in the US in the hurdles. And so a lot of people assume that when you go to run for, you know, another country or smaller country, that you're taking the easy route. You know, you want to go make a team that's easy. Well, it's not like I was, you know, at the bottom of the barrel in the U.S. You know, I was in the top at the U.S. as well. And had I decided to continue running for the U.S., my entire endorsement contract setup and all of that would have been different, because I had companies, specifically one, that wanted to sign me right out of college and throw all these things at me. And then the moment they realized I was running for Nigeria, they pulled everything and only gave me equipment. Like, I got no money, nothing. And so a lot of people don't see those type of sacrifices that come, but it was something that I was committed to. That I said, you know, if I ever become a professional athlete, I want to run for Nigeria. And then there's another part of that, right? There's the whole like business aspect of it, the sacrifices made with that. But especially during that time, there was also the cultural differences, right? Yeah. Like being raised, like you mentioned, in the diaspora, it's like, okay, your Nigerian-ness is questioned when you come to compete for the country. It's like, okay, you come of Nigerian descent, so we'll accept you because you relate to us, but you're really not us. Like, you're really not Nigerian. And so there becomes this divide of people who were raised and who had the opportunities in the diaspora versus the homegrown athletes. And that was what I entered into, because again, being a person of privilege in that sense, we were introduced to all these different resources that we could train with that they don't necessarily have in Nigeria. And so there's an advantage, right? You have a system that you can train up through. You have, you know, resources and tracks and equipment and all these things that are just readily available to you, where we fight every day to try and get access to these things. And so there's an advantage there. You know, you leave from there to come here and make this team. And so I had to really help break down some of those barriers as well within the team, within the construct of the federation, to understand that, look, we're all in this together. You know, we are one.
I love that. And I resonate a lot with what you're saying. in terms of the diaspora, not actually like from Africa or Nigeria, the country that you're from, but still trying to contribute, you know, for the betterment of whatever organization or passions you have. And even just going on to, because you said that you were quite adamant that you want to represent Nigeria. Was there like a particular reason why behind that?
Yeah. So I never really saw myself being a professional athlete at a point in time. Like when I was in college, like, yeah, it's always in the back of your mind, right? When you do sports, you want to compete at the best, you know, the highest level. Like I wanted to go to the NBA. You know, I thought that I was going to be a basketball player. And so when this whole track journey came, yeah, I knew of the Olympics, but like, I really wasn't gung-ho about being an Olympian, mostly because of my health challenges. And so it wasn't until after I had my second heart surgery, which was in college, in university, my final year, that the trajectory of my entire athletic career changed. And when that happened, I was like, oh, okay, well, now there's a possibility for me to keep running and try and do these Olympic Games. So I knew that I had contributed so much of who I am as an individual to where I live in the United States. You know, I've given so much, I've contributed to the development and the success and all these things in America, but there was a part of my identity that I identify with every single day that I've done nothing for. So I said, if I ever become a professional athlete, that's what I'm going to do. Because I watched the opening ceremonies of the Olympics in 2004, I believe, in Athens. And I remember sitting in the living room and we had guests over at the time and the opening ceremonies came on and I saw so much joy just overcoming Nigerian people. They were so proud. And that was like when 419 was at its peak and there were all these different things that people were talking down on Nigeria all the time. And I looked around and saw how much pride and joy people had to be Nigerian because of the Olympic Games. And I was like, you know what? That's what I want to do. I want to contribute that type of joy because we're really a good people in this world.
Yeah. I love that. That's such a strong story. And even the, no, honestly, and even like, as you mentioned, just resonating with the culture and seeing the joy that sports brings and actually being in a position to provide that. I mean, only a few people are able to experience that. So I can imagine that's such like a precious thing to hold on to, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Now, it was definitely a gem jewel that a pride that I still hold near and dear to me and a choice that I would make over and over again. I knew it was going to be challenging. I knew there were going to be challenges. I knew it was going to be difficult to assimilate to this new life and new culture. There was going to be a bit of a shock. There were going to be a lot of things. And I was prepared for it. I was like, this is what I want to do. So whatever comes with it, hey, every day is just going to be a new adventure. You know, I just placed in my mind that I manage all my expectations by having none. Whatever happens, happens. But I just know what my intention is. And that's the contribute the most and the best that I can to Nigeria, to Africa. And that's still, you know, the underlying theme that I still have in my life right now with the work that I do for Nigeria. It's always been rooted in that. It's always been rooted in how can I do the best that I can to know that when I leave this world, I've left it in a place that has created opportunities, not just for me and who I am as an American, but also me and who I am as a Nigerian.
Yeah, no, that's amazing. You touched on many things, you know, representing Nigeria, going to London 2012. But in all of that, I mean, we'll continue talking about your career with the bobsled and everything that you've done, but I can even imagine in that early stage, as you mentioned already, in terms of the different, like, maybe cultures or environments, having loads of deals lined up. You then revealed you're representing Nigeria, everything is more or less gone. But how important, right, like a key skill in leadership or in life in general is the importance of like discipline. So just as an elite athlete and as someone who's doing a lot now in the development of a sport in Nigeria, how important is discipline?
it's probably the most important thing that you'll have, right? Mm-hmm. Discipline is such a powerful word because it's so complex, right? And it incorporates so many different things. Like, for example, discipline doesn't only apply to a regimen, right? To training, to what you eat, mm-hmm. to, you know, it applies to an entire mindset, how you approach life. You know, like your idea of even programming yourself. And I think that discipline, you know, it goes across the spectrum of time management. And without discipline, your success is very volatile, right? Like it can blow up and it can yeah. be inconsistent. But when you have discipline, you also create a level of consistency that allows you to be successful. Discipline mm-hmm. is the most underrated anchor of success that I think people miss. Because if you don't anchor yourself in some level of discipline, then it's difficult for you to anchor yourself in some level of consistency. And most times your success is gonna come when you have created a particular level of consistency. That's not to say that you can't hit something and be successful, but that's yep. just a moment, right? That's a mm-hmm. successful moment. In order mm-hmm. to generate true success, you have to be able to do things on a consistent basis, and that requires discipline. And I had to have a lot of it, that's for sure.
Yeah, I'm sure some of it, a lot of it probably innate, but definitely some is just grown as you face challenges and just that consistency.
For yeah. real, because discipline also applies to your attitude. Right. Mm-hmm. Which is, I think, the most important thing, because in being able to do things like compete at the highest level of sport or do anything, it's transferable. Yeah. Right. Like, be the best parent you can be the best spouse you can be the best boss you can be. Right. Like yeah. these things require you to have discipline of self. Right. And that is recognition of your emotions. Mm-hmm. That is being honest enough with yourself to know the things that you need to do, being able to discern between what's important and what's not, choosing your battles wisely. You know, all of these things are very, very transferable, and they relate specifically to what type of mental discipline you have.
Yeah, discipline is so important.
And
it's definitely helped you do so much. Like, even for people that don't know, right? Mm-hmm. I'm going to say even a few of the accolades that you've or barriers that you've broken, right? So first African bobsled driver to compete at the Winter Olympics, which was Pyeongchang 2018, as I mentioned. Yeah. So you and Ngozi and Okuma made the first African or Nigerian bobsled team to compete at the Winter Olympics. First mm-hmm. African summer and winter Olympian, yeah. Participated in 100 meters London 2012, as you mentioned, two-time African champion as well. There's just so much that you've done,
yeah.
like, I was going to say on the field, but as an athlete, but even like off the field as well. Yeah. We spoke about your transition during COVID. So even by the age of 30, right, you completed two bachelor degrees, which is Nigerian household as well, is very important, and two master's degrees as well. So yeah, even you mentioned, you know, the whole discipline, not just on the field, but also outside of that, especially, which I'm sure has been key to allow you to do and even achieve so much. So yeah, okay. So London 2012, I'm sure that was an amazing moment. But then in 2014, you then decided to switch to like Winter Olympics. What was the idea or thinking behind that? And I'm sure were many people taken aback or surprised by that decision?
Yeah, I was taken aback and surprised. You know, like I didn't, I was like, at first it was kind of like a joke, you know, in my mind. It was mm-hmm. like, okay, like we're not really, like, this is just, you know, let's just look it up. Let's see what happens, you know, what's out there. It was actually rooted in I retired from track and field in 2012, but I never announced it, which was really strange.
Did you decide that after the London 2012 or did you decide that before?
Oh, I knew before. Oh, before okay. I knew. I knew that in 2009 when I graduated from university, of the University of Houston. My coach convinced me to continue to run because he was like, you know, ever since I had the heart surgery, it was just like I skyrocketed. And he said he felt like we were gypped of 3 years together. You know, that I really have what it takes to compete at the highest level of sport, and that if I just gave it a shot, I could probably make it to the game. Mm-hmm. And I had already checked out mentally from sport. Like, I was already done. I had gotten into a graduate program in a totally different state. I was on to the next chapter. But when he talked to me, he convinced me to stay in Houston, he convinced me to keep training. He offered me a job and offered to pay for my second degree. I was like, okay, this makes way too much sense. I'm just going to go ahead and stay here. So I was actually not planning on competing for those years. So I was like, I'm going to give this 3 years. Mm-hmm. And every single day, part of that discipline and that regiment was my commitment to myself daily to say, I'm going to give everything I have in these next 3 years to prove to myself that I can compete with the best in the world at the highest stage. Mm-hmm. So I knew when the Olympics were over that that was it. I knew my last race was going to be in August. Well, I was hoping it wasn't August 6th, but that was when it was because I didn't get out of the first round. But yeah, I knew that that was going to be my last race. So, yeah.
So, I mean, you just mentioned that it took quite a bit of convincing for you to continue. But why Winter Olympics? Did you know at that moment?
Exactly.
Talk to us through that process.
Exactly. Yes, that's where I was going with this. Thank you for bringing it. So,
that's all good.
So I continued coaching. So after I retired in 2012, I knew I was done.
Yeah.
And when I just was coaching, I was coaching track and field at University of Houston, men's and women's sprinters and hurdlers. And it was while I was coaching that I realized I needed to go back to school because there was something that was missing in sports medicine. I realized that I could see things, but I couldn't understand if it was happening because people's bodies were failing them or because they just weren't, you know, they weren't trained enough and they needed to do more drills. And so I decided to resign from coaching in 2014. To go back to school. And for the first time in my entire life, I was just an athlete. Mm-hmm. And I was just a student. I was just a student. I was doing nothing in athletics, not coaching, not competing, nothing. And then I started to realize that my journey as a professional athlete, there were a lot of things that I found out or that happened to me that could have been prevented had there been people who really understood a little bit more about sports medicine. And I was like, you know, in order for me as a Black woman to be able to help create the type of change that I know is necessary in sports medicine, I need to get back into a sport. Mm-hmm. I was like, going to an Olympics is great, right? Being an Olympian, it's like, okay, that gets me a seat at the table to have these conversations with, like, you know, World Cup champions or, you know, Premier League champions or NFL champions, whatever. But that may not be enough to convince people that I know exactly what I'm talking about or what I'm doing. Because unfortunately, that's still kind of, you know, the terrain in the sports medicine space as a Black woman. Mm-hmm. And so I said, well, if I competed in another sport, then I would not only understand what's happening in the sports right now, but then I would also be able to use that as ammunition for these conversations to really help people in their careers. And so that was really the driving force to what got me into winter sports, because that 2014 also happened to be a Winter Olympic year. And I had some friends that had gone from track and field to winter sports that were competing on the U.S. bobsled team. And so, just the natural cheering for them, being happy for them, that was what brought my attention to the sport. And I started thinking, I was like, wait a minute, I could do this sport. I think I can do this because I knew I wasn't going back to track. Like, I was over it. So that was basically what sparked the idea. And so I started searching. I was like, you know, does Africa and does Nigeria, you know, of course, nothing. No bobsled teams, no nothing for Nigeria. And so I looked and I said, okay, I can join the U.S. team, which is what I did. I was in the U.S. team for a year. When I was on that team, I really learned that, you know, the sport was trying to grow. that, you know, they wanted more women in the sports. Africa mm-hmm. needed to be represented. There was no representation. And by this time, it was like 2016, because I mm-hmm. competed from U.S. from 2015 to 2016. And I was like, okay, this is really kind of insane that an entire continent of people in this day and age have not been represented in a sport like this on a big stage. Mm-hmm. And so being that I was like African champion, Nigerian champion for several years, I had a platform where I could actually have a real discussion to make this happen. And yeah. so I just used my resources and started the federation. And then I found teammates. And then I started the team. Like, it was really, it became a thing that grew beyond what I originally yeah. thought, which was just mm-hmm. to get into another sport so I could learn more about sports and possibly yeah. at another Olympic. It became so much bigger than that. It became now like we have almost 2 billion people and their diaspora effect that
yeah.
have never been represented in this sport. Like, we need, their representation is key. And now we yeah. need to do something about it.
Yeah. Did you, once you embarked on this journey, right, did you, and you started having those conversations you mentioned mm-hmm. with people involved in Nigeria, did you ever receive, even today, do you receive like, not backlash, but like, this is Africa, it's just hot, like, what are we doing with bobsled? And if so, like, how have you dealt with some of those, I don't know, setbacks or just those comments or ideals that come your way?
I'm laughing because that's the story of, you know, this journey, right? Like, how do you create a winter sport for a sub-Saharan African country? It doesn't even make sense. It's just like the entire census is an oxymoron. You know, it's just like none of it aligns. And so I have to be one very calculated in the way that I even brought this about, because the thing about Nigeria and Nigerians, and I love my Nigerian-ness and I love mm-hmm. Nigerians in general, but we get in our own way a lot. Mm-hmm. We get in our own way a lot, and we do have a lot of pride. Mm-hmm. But if you can use both of those things and create space for them to work either with each other or against each other for the greater mm-hmm. good, then mm-hmm. you actually get things done. And that's what I did. So I knew that we were in our own way because obviously Nigeria didn't want this. They're like, what's our business? Why are we even looking at this? And I also knew that we had so much pride that if I was able to create it and get the world excited about it, Nigerians would not push it away because they don't want to look bad. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know this was going to happen. I just was like, well, let me just, you know, launch a GoFundMe. And when I launch this GoFundMe, I will make it my gift to Nigeria. I'm not asking Nigeria for anything, because mm-hmm. that's another thing. If you ask him for this, they now already don't want it. It's just going to get pushed to the side. If you want something to happen, you got to create it you got to think outside the box. And so I said, okay, this is my gift. You guys don't have to give me anything. I'm giving this to you. So mm-hmm. now you're a little bit more receptive to, like, you're giving me a gift. Okay, what's this gift? Because Nigerians are also appreciative type of people. You know, like, they may not like it or want it, but they'll be like, oh, okay, thank you. And then let's put it on the side. So that was what allowed me to open some eyes and ears. I have a mm-hmm. gift for you. Then this will be Nigeria's gift to Africa. So then mm-hmm. you give Nigeria, you feed the prize, right? You feed our pride. Not only am I giving you a gift, but when this is successful, you get to own it and say that you did it and give it to Africa. Mm-hmm. Everyone wins, you know? And so when I launched the GoFundMe, I didn't realize that it was going to go viral like it did, but it did. Mm-hmm. It did, and it did multiple times. And because of that, Nigeria was kind of placed with their backs against the wall as far as like policy and sports and things like that, where they couldn't go in and say, I couldn't do it, because now mm-hmm. the rest of the world was excited about it. Mm-hmm. And so they had to just kind of sit there and even though they didn't understand, they had to just be like, okay, we see this is happening. And then when they started to understand, again, getting out of their own way, then they started to see the value in having a winter sports federation representing the continent, because it's just bigger than the fact that we don't have snow in our country.
Yeah, No, makes sense. How long did that process actually take, you know, from the whole GoFundMe and then liaising with the relevant people to them, like, say, finally saying, okay, cool. Like, how long did that process actually take?
It was kind of record time, to be honest. Oh. I started the Federation. Yeah, it was. So what a lot of people don't know is there was already a Winter Federation set up in Nigeria. Oh. One for Skeleton. It was called the Skeleton, the Nigerian Skeleton Federation, NSF. Mm-hmm. And there was a young man at the time whose name is also Sheon, who started that because he wanted to do Skeleton. And I remembered seeing his story as like a ESPN short. Mm-hmm. When I was right after the, I think going into 2014 Winter Olympics, because it was after I'd already competed in the Summer Olympics. And I remember hearing his story and his challenges and the struggles of creating a Winter Federation for Nigeria. And I remember watching him being like, man, I feel for you. And I was like, dang, his name is Sheon too. I was like, man, I've been there with you, boss. I was like, I wish you all the best. But that story stuck in the back of my mind. So when I started the Federation, I didn't start it at first. At first, I went to go find him. I went to go try and search out the Federation that was already there for Skeleton mm-hmm. and Bobsled. And I found them, you know, and it was like, yes, we can do this. We, you know, the two Sheons, it was great. There was,
yeah.
He has an incredible story and I admired him and his story so much. And so I was like, let's do this. But unfortunately, because of the fact that this was uncharted territory and the way that Nigeria is set up, he had to create an entity that was now governed by the CAC in Nigeria, which is they are the governing body of all business entities.
Okay.
Like, they're the ones who give you your, like, what you can and cannot do mm-hmm. in whatever you're creating as far, you have to get approval. So the way that he set up the Federation, he had to basically, it's being governed by a body that doesn't even matter when it comes to yeah. sports. Because mm-hmm. the only thing that matters in Olympic sports is the Nigerian Olympic Committee and the international governing body, which is the International Bobsled and Skeleton Federation of Nigeria. So mm-hmm. because he created it with the sport of skeleton and not bobsled inside of it, but we, per our international federation, you can only have one federation. So I couldn't create a bobsled only mm-hmm. federation. Yeah. So there was actually this huge, huge issue that spanned probably for about maybe 6 months. However, mm-hmm. it took him 7 years to create Whoa. This federation. Wow. And I was able to use, because I had all these different relationships with the mm-hmm. important bodies, we were able to get it done in like 6 months.
Wow.
And create the Federation. So 6 months to create the Federation. Then I had to become a driver. I had to mm-hmm. learn how to drive a bobsled. I had to find teammates. And I had to now qualify for the Olympics. And I had to do all of that in a year and a half.
Wow. I've got questions for each of those. So even like, which one should I start off with? Do you know what? Let me start with this question. So 7 years mm-hmm. for the show that you saw,
yeah,
and then 6 months for you. Mm-hmm. And an often question is, you know, navigating Africa, how people may have perception that it's very hard or whatever it is. But from your experience, how, especially again being a diaspora, right? How did you find it actually navigating in there? I know you mentioned already between about the egos and whatnot, and either putting them against each other or working with it in tandem. But just in general as well, just navigating that space, like how much of a challenge was it for you or adjusting to those different environments?
It was extremely challenging and it still is. It mm-hmm. very much is. And it's just because the culture of sport in Africa, and especially Nigeria, wasn't always looked at as one that was financially motivated.
Viable, yeah.
Like, people were not looking at sport as saying like, oh, you can make a career out of sport in Nigeria. It's like, no, that's a hobby. You know, you are to do lawyer, doctor, engineer, you know, all of the things that will make you money. this is just something you're doing for play. Eventually it will end and that's it. So in order for people to take it serious enough to see it as something that can make a difference, they need to be able to have systems in place for it. But if you don't take it serious enough, those grassroots and developmental systems that lead to success aren't in place. So you have, like I said, you have now this entity, this body that is governing a sports federation and an automotive company, you know, and it's like they have no idea what it even takes to compete at the Olympics, but they're the ones telling you whether or not you can create a sport. And so now it becomes, well, when I'm talking, thankfully, being a Nigerian, you know, a national champion in Africa and in Nigeria, I was able to have relationships with everyone that was at the top of these international governing
organizations,
bodies.
Yeah.
Exactly. So my, unfortunately, the other Shaun, he didn't have those relationships, right? And so in Nigeria also, it becomes a thing about who you know. Right. Yep. So I went straight to the top and I called the people at the top and said, look, this is what we have at the head of the Nigerian Olympic Committee. And our head of Nigerian Olympic Committee also works in the International Olympic Committee. And then because the International Bobsled and Skeleton Federation was looking to build more teams, they sent help from the top too, because they wanted to add Africa to compete at these Olympics. So I was talking to the tops of everyone, and I had basically created a WhatsApp group, you know, for everybody. I was like, look, what do we have to do? Tell me what I have to do. I'll get it done. And so that's why that journey, whereas Shell literally, and he's an attorney, and he literally had to create all these processes, go back and forth, spend probably hundreds of thousands of dollars to go back and forth to Nigeria, talk to someone who was just going to sit his file on their desk for the next 3 months, 5 months, because they don't even know what to do with it. You know, and so that's why things are a challenge in Nigeria. It really is. And it still is to this day, because we're still trying to create infrastructures that allow for sports to even develop properly.
100%. And so I'm sure people listening thinking, I don't want to get involved in that.
It's
definitely not for the faint heart. But I guess, as you mentioned, even at the beginning, you had a deep reasoning that's keeping you, that's driving you, right? A purpose more than just, you know, generating money, etc. But thinking long term, and you talk about that legacy and the emotions that you want to give people, which is extremely important, I believe, because it's not every day it's going to be all rosy and all smiles and fun. There's going to be quite a few hard times. And so I guess remembering the reason why you started on this journey really keeps you going through the
sometimes that's the only thing that keeps me locked in, because it's like I said, it's not for the faint heart, and it is extremely frustrating, right? But then you look at it and you think to yourself, if I'm in a position where I can make a change and I allow myself to be defeated, how long will it take for somebody else to get into this type of position? And if somebody doesn't, you know, be on the front line, how do you establish protection for those that are behind you? You know, and so I just see myself almost like a martyr in this space, you know, and whatever needs to happen just needs to happen. And that's what it is. When you're a trailblazer, you are a martyr, right? Like, you're taking some L's that people behind you will never have to take, because you're there first. You're on that front line. And so I think that is when you start thinking about bigger purpose, bigger legacy. And if you're a person of faith, you know, your service to God, which is what I feel. You know, I feel like that's exactly what I'm a woman of service, and that is what God has put me on this planet to do, is to establish opportunities for those coming behind me. And it's not going to be hard. It's not going to be pretty, but it's necessary. And if I'm able to do it, then I should.
Love that. Fantastic. Good. Honestly, real good. It's good. These are the stuff that we need to hear. Because, you know, sports is really... it's great, it's exciting, as you mentioned, it brings so much joy, but to actually, which is what my organization is all about, to actually develop something sustainable, we need to talk about some of these leadership skills and aspects and actually what needs to be done to actually make like a shift and improve standards and levels so that it's not, there isn't just one Shell and Addy Gwynn that's making it. Mm-hmm. We have many more stories coming in the future. Another aspect. So you mentioned bobsled, you set it up and you got two of your friends involved.
Mm-hmm.
How was that in terms of selling the idea to them, convincing them, getting them on board, and not just like halfway through, but seeing it through to the end with you? How was that whole process in convincing them?
It wasn't really a huge process, believe it or not. Oh, cool. Thankfully, I had previously already established a relationship with Ngozi because I was her coach at University of Houston. Yeah. And so we had a very, very strong relationship where, and I was kind of just that coach that poured into to the athletes a lot. And so even when they graduated, I would make time to sit down and have lunch and dinner and talk through ideas and, you know, just help them, not just as athletes, but as people. And I think that that's something that even her family had picked up on before she came to university. Yeah. And so that was one of the reasons why she ended up coming to University of Houston. And so when we were having a conversation just on, you know, lunch, you know, we just sat down and, you know, I was listening to kind of where her journey had taken her at that point. And she just happened to ask me, you know, like, so what are you up to now? Because by that time I had resigned from coaching. And then that, it just so happened that I was on this pathway to starting a federation for bobsled. And so when I told her, she was like, that sounds like something I might be interested in. I was like, really? And she was like, yeah, let me think on it for a second. And then I'll get back to you. And I was like, okay. I think I just got a breakman. Like, whoa. Like, I wasn't even expecting that, you know?
Yeah.
And so, like I said, I was on the U.S. team for a year. And so when I was on the team, I understood what it was like to be a brakeman. So there are two positions, two primary positions in bobsled. There's the driver who sits in the front, and then there's the brakeman who sits in the back. Now, for men, you can have up to three brakemen because they can do a four-man. But for women, it's only two people in a sled. So it's typically just the driver and the brakeman. But when I was on the U.S. team, I was the only brakeman for some people. And I just remembered that ride feeling awful. Like, it just doesn't feel great. And the chiropractor in me was thinking about the spine. And so I was like, you know what? I want to have two brakemen because I want them to be able to switch out and, you know, not too rough on their body and blah, blah, blah. So it just so happened that summer, a very good friend of mine, he called me and told me that, you know, someone who was like his little sister was moving to Houston. And he wanted to connect me to her, and that he told her that I was just like a person to know in the city. And we ended up just connecting, and she moved to Houston on a whim. Aquama just came. She was just like, I want a change of environment. And so she just moved to Houston, you know? So it wasn't like she had, you know, she was obviously, she had stacked up some money to come, and she was looking for work and things, but she was also an athlete. She ran for the University of Minnesota. And so I was like, you know, just in us having lunch and meeting, and I ended up telling her about it. And she was like, she's the daredevil. She loves stuff like that. She's the adrenaline junkie. So I didn't even have to really sell it to her. Like, once I finally told her what I was into, I was like, you know, would you want to do this with me? And she was like, yeah.
That's cool. That's really cool. And yeah, you guys, like, you put together a wonderful team, and it's just a great story, to be honest with you.
Thank you.
Just doing something uncharted. And again, like, you know, being a trailblazer and being an example for, you know, those that will come after you. But it was really good. Honestly, working it back then, watching you guys, it was great. It was great. I think that Winter Olympics, there's a few other African athletes that participated. Was it Skeleton?
Yep, Akwasi.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That was the year for Africa. It was really, really good. We had a really good showing at those Olympics. And that's, I think, what kind of opened up the continent a lot more to the Olympics and the Winter Olympics. And even now, there are some very grassroots programs that have been born since then that are opening up the opportunity for more African nations to qualify and compete in the Winter Olympics, including the Youth Olympic Games, which are happening next year, where we've been developing athletes from Tunisia, Nigeria, Ghana, South Africa, like literally so many different countries in Africa. So it has been amazing. I mean, even Simi Dele Adeagbo, she joined us. So there were four of us who went in 2018, and Simi, she still continued to do the sport, and she's still continuing. She's going to give it another go for Milano Cortina and qualify in the monobob, hopefully.
Great. I watched one of the videos on your, well, not your YouTube page, but the BSF YouTube page, and for the trials and how you guys do it in Nigeria.
Yeah,
it's really cool. And Kelechi from AFT.
Yes, that's my boy.
Yeah, the funny guy. But how has, like, I guess what's next, but also how has things moved since you decided to call it a day with winter sports? That has things progressed as much as you like? And I guess what's next? You probably already alluded to, you know, having more engagement, more countries for the youth games, but yeah, thought to ask that.
Yes, it's been growing. Unfortunately, you know, we started it and competed in 2018. 2019 was our next full season of really just trying to learn to develop and grow and explain and teach people of what it means to be a winter federation. And then, you know, unfortunately after the pandemic came and shut everything down, right? And so, you know, you can imagine in that type of momentum where something like that is fueled off of its momentum, right? And off of what everyone else is saying and doing with it because they don't understand, right? It's hard to, like, even for me, people are like, you're still doing this? Like, you're still a part of the federation? And I'm like, yeah, you know, like, I can't create something for the country that they've never seen before, didn't ask for, don't know how to run, and be like, okay, here you go. See you later. Have fun. You know, like, someone has to help them establish before, you know, like, kind of tapering out of it. And so it has been challenging because we really had to start from ground zero in 2021, you know, and this is 2023. So, you know, we feel like we're only 2 years old, even though we made such a global impact as a federation in 2018. It carried over, but the structural infrastructure part of it did not. And another challenge with that is that when you go viral, right, which so many people, they want to go viral, they want to, you know, be famous, they want to do all these things. That wasn't even the intent here, right? And although it happened, viral, imagine going from like 0 to 100, right? You're somewhere, but even say, let's say you go from 20 to 100, you've made a little bit of a way, people understand a little bit of what's going on, and then now you just boom to 100, just like that in one day. Well, the reality is you're still responsible for all the numbers between 21 and 99. You're still responsible for them, even though you're at 100 now. And the problem is that you don't always know, well, what was number 68? What's number 67? Those things you don't, because you never experienced the process of building something to that height,
that's true.
You don't know what you missed in that building process. And so much of it becomes exposed when you're dealing with something like a global pandemic, which roots you back down to zero and you're trying to get back to 100. You know, you're like, well, shoot, how did I get to 100 the first time? Well, I skipped, you know, 90 numbers. So now I have to figure it out. So that's the challenge of developing, especially an international federation for sport. And it's just a daily thing. We're constantly trying to keep building, just people volunteer, because again, you align with what people want to do in their spirit. You know, people want to give back, people want to find ways to contribute to the country, and that's the way that we allow for it. So it's been good. It's been good. We're going to have our fifth annual trials this year, and that's us selecting athletes to compete in the International Federation for representing Nigeria, and we're working on qualifying the next class of Winter Olympians from Nigeria in the sports of bobsled. Ever since we started that federation, that was the only recognized federation from the NOC. Now we have four winter federations in Nigeria. We've got curling, skiing, bobsled, skeleton, and luge. So it's growing slowly, slowly.
I like that. I guess, sorry, I'm just thinking. I always have a question for days, like, but it's just amazing, the story. It's not pretty, but this is how it is, isn't it, right?
That's life, yeah.
In order to, now, what do you think, because I'm thinking, you spoke about you have the youth Winter Games next year, and a similar challenge to maybe in cycling. So cycling Africa is good, but it's not the level as maybe your other continents. And so when it does come to like that elite level, African athletes kind of struggle to really compete competitively because just the level of standards. Like, I know it's still, bobsled is still very young, but do some of the athletes, are they facing similar issues in terms of their competitiveness? So that when it gets to your Olympics, etc., then it's like, it's great to be there, but you want to be there, compete well, sort of thing.
Absolutely. I mean, and that was our thing even in 2018. You got to respect the process, right? Because it's just like saying, just because you have your driver's permit and you can operate a motor vehicle, it doesn't mean you can drive well, you know?
Yeah.
I'm not going to throw you into F1, you know, Formula One. You still got to learn to drive on the streets first before you can get to Formula One, right? And that's basically what it's like in this sport. You know, like, just because you, like, oh, I can do this. Yeah, you can do it, but that doesn't mean that you can do it well or at a high level. And it takes time, right? These people who drive Formula One, they've been driving, you know, like this probably since they were pushing go-karts as kids, right? Like, these are things that take time to develop. And so, yeah, we have to be creative with the way that we are competitive, because we don't have that time advantage. You know, some of these nations are 100 years ahead of us as far as the sport. And so literally 100 years, like the sport's been around. Mm. And so here we are coming in trying to compete with the highest level, and none of us want to close the gate. None of us want to be last. You know, we all want to be fighting for a spot on the podium. And so that's been our priority, is how do we get our athletes on ice more to allow them to develop and create other opportunities for them to develop, which would be like simulation. You know, how do we use technology, innovation to help advance our athletes, so that where we are short financially and resource-wise and even terrain-wise, we can make up for it with innovation and technology. And so that's kind of where we are right now in developing, because we want to be very competitive and we want to get to Milano Cortina and be fighting for a spot on the podium.
Love that. No, this is great. So I guess what's next? You've done track and field, obviously you're still heavily involved with bobsled, but I guess is Sharon the person? What's next?
Well, what's next for me is what I've been building with my practice.
Okay.
You said?
Now, I say, what's next, or what's the focus for you now?
So I have my practice. So I'm a doctor of chiropractic sports medicine and a biomechanist, a sports biomechanist. So I treat
I don't even know what that means.
So the biomechanics of the human body is basically the physics of movement. So like the movement of the biology, the physics of the human body, the anatomy. Okay. And so people in biomechanics sometimes will focus on like prosthetics, you know, like if someone has lost a limb, how do we create a limb that allows them to still get their same motor behavior, their same angles, things like that. And so, but the specific biomechanics I do is actually in the sport. So it's looking at what are the optimal movement patterns that someone needs, what type of angles and forces are put on the muscles that are normal or abnormal that could lead to injury, or how do we prevent injury from happening in the future? And then as a chiropractor, I can treat it. because I understand all the things about the actual anatomy. And so that's what I do professionally and day in and day out. I also do a lot of work with what I've built in sports, essentially in a bit of an ambassador role with Nigeria when it comes to sports and entertainment, bridging the gap between the diaspora and the continent and allowing people the opportunity to not only participate, give back to the country and the continent, but also be involved and engaged and represent the country and continent in the ability that they have. And also help at a policy level. Like you said earlier, these things require, you know, they require building, you know, an infrastructure system in place. And we are in a huge wave of people and countries and policymakers wanting to be on the continent. You know, Africa is the youngest continent in the world. Yeah. It also has the youngest population of youth in the world. Mm-hmm. And so how do we engage that continental, you know, resource? And then how do we allow it to benefit us as people of the continent, right? Like not other people, you know, like other, you know, colonizing type countries. So, so that's basically what I'm up to. Yeah, you know, get married, have some kids, all those things.
I love it. No, that's great. That's so important in terms of, as you mentioned, Africa is rich in resources, like raw materials, but also culture and the people, and really connecting. And yeah, sports entertainment is such a strong vehicle that we've seen with the likes of, even in music, your Burna Boys performing in the States in front of huge crowds as well.
Yeah.
Like Thames as well performing.
Yeah.
It's really like global. It's opening loads of doors and really trying to connect that and making sure that, you know, everyone benefits.
Yeah,
like you said, using resources to help advance and make things better. Hats off to you about that. And you're also running, correct me if I'm wrong, Dr. Shaun Cares as well, in terms of like providing, like, is it food and things like that for families across Nigeria?
Yeah, so that was a huge project that I did during the pandemic. Yeah. And then I just do a lot of things that are just kind of under that envelope of, you know, just the person that I am that wants to give back. Whenever I do, that's more so in, that's like a division of like the Dr. Shaun brand, where it's just like, you know, Dr. Shaun cares, which I do, I care.
No, that's good, it makes sense. I hope lots of people have taken some sort of lessons from your journey and your story. It's really encouraging. Honestly, thanks and hats off to you. And I guess you've done so much, like, but in terms of maybe people who have maybe, people who you perhaps look up to for like expertise and experience, like, how important is that for you in order to keep you going? Because you do so much on the field, off the field, everything else, even your career now, your professional career, like sports science, like how are you managing all of that? And like I said, like having those people around you, other leaders that you can share some, learn things from and help to encourage you.
Yeah, I've learned, especially as I've gotten older, the importance of mentors.
Yeah.
And just being able to anchor yourself in like-minded people, not just your mentors, but even like your friend circle, right? People who encourage you, who don't allow you to dim your light, or who see you for who you are and want you to reach the next level of excellence if that's what you want. Mm-hmm. And then also people who've been there and done that, right? And so they can see a mile away what type of trajectory you have, and they can help you navigate it. And so that's been a lot of what I've spent a lot of my last few years doing is one, getting around more like-minded people, people that, you know, I now call my friends who have been down this journey, and we can talk about some of the same things while still allowing myself to be anchored into, you know, the friends that I've had for decades, right?
Yeah.
But then also just finding good mentors, right? Like people who understand, like, Shaun, you can't handle doing everything. You can't do all of it. Not everything at once. You need help. You know, this is what you need to put in place. These are the systems that are necessary. So that's been really, really, really helpful. And I always encourage people to find your helpers. You know, don't allow yourself to be overwhelmed and burdened by the need or desire or pressure of trying to do everything yourself, because you don't have to. No matter what it is that you're doing, the most successful things that you're going to do in life are going to come when you have a support system that pushes you towards it.
I can't say any more than that. So you summarized that wonderfully, honestly. Well said. But no, thank you so much. Thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it. Sharing some of your knowledge and insight into your journey and the wonderful things that you have done and that you will continue to do as well. So thank you so much. I actually have one more question. If anyone follows you on social media, they know that you like music, you like to dance. So, you know, apart from maybe outside of the dancing and singing and even cooking that you like to do, like, what other hobbies do you like to do to maybe wind down, or just things that keep you going?
Honestly, it really is like the dancing, singing, cooking. Like, those are like my strong three, right? Strong three. And then spending time with friends and family. I feel like as we get older, you also recognize how valuable it is to have to have the time to spend with people, and being very intentional about spending that with friends and family. And so whatever that looks like, whether we go to the park, whether we sit at a house and stare at each other and laugh, or, you know, I like to spend a lot of time with my friends and family. So that those are like, and then I dance, sing, and cook in those spaces. Like, so that's basically my life. Like, when I'm not out trying to essentially save the world and do all the things, I am just chilling. I love a good chill session, watch a good movie, spend time with friends, and just, you know, just vibe, and family, just vibe. I'm totally that person.
love that. But no, thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome.
Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
For those that have listened, I hope that you've taken something tangible from Shaun's story, and some of the skills that she's had to either innate or she's had to pick up on a journey for all that she's done and all that she continues to do. So thank you all for listening, and Shaun, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Gabriel, and hope everyone has an amazing rest of the day.
Thank you. Take care. Thank you.